From KUER News in Salt Lake City, this is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Today in the program, we're talking about what it was like to live through Watergate. We're profiling a podcast called Slow Burn. It's about the scandal that brought down Richard Nixon. And the host, the journalist Leon Neyfakh, wanted to know what it would have felt like in the 1970s to absorb that daily drip of news as the story played out. How and why did people defend Richard Nixon? And could this have ended in some other way? Join us in just a moment.
Do you have an old station wagon full of memories and a busted transmission? Yeah, join the club. Give that car, or any car, a new lease on life by donating it to KUER. We'll have it picked up for you, so really it couldn't be easier. Then we split the proceeds with our car donation partner, and the money goes straight into the programming you love to listen to in the car. It's a regular public radio circle of life. Look under the support tab at KUER.org to learn more about car donation.
This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. There's a podcast you may have heard of. It's from Slate. It's called Slow Burn. It's about Watergate. And when you hear about Watergate now, it's history. It was a massive scandal, of course, that brought down a president. But the host of the podcast, Leon Neyfakh, says you have to remember that when the Watergate break-in happened in 1972, Richard Nixon had an approval rating of nearly 70%, and even after the news broke, he still won a huge landslide victory over George McGovern. Neyfakh says that as the news starts to come out about the shady dealings of Nixon's campaign operatives and the financial link between the Watergate burglars and the committee to reelect the president, you would think this would be huge news. But it wasn't. Not at first. Watergate didn't take off for more than a year, really. And part of what Neyfakh is exploring in Slow Burn is why. Why didn't the story captivate the electorate like it does now? Well, today in the program, we're talking about the podcast Slow Burn, what it was like to experience that scandal as it played out in real time, and why it was so many Americans continued to stand by Richard Nixon, even as it became clear he had abused his power. Leon Neyfakh is a staff writer for Slate.com, host, as I said, of the podcast called Slow Burn. The first season is now available online. We have a link to that on our website, radiowest.org. He joined us from Slate's studios in Brooklyn. I guess, Leon, I wanted to get this out of the way. The question of why do this now? Because on one hand, of course, it's obvious to people, you know, the connections between then and now. But you've been really careful about not being too, I think as you've put it, not too overbearing or obvious about that parallel between Nixon and Trump. So just say a little bit about that, because in some ways it's not really what the podcast is about. It's but obviously people are going to notice.
Absolutely. So, you know, when we decided to do the show, our motivation was that we thought it would be illuminating to look back at the last time in our country's history when the federal government seemed like it was in such a precarious situation, and the last time in our country's history when it seemed like the news was just so relentlessly unpredictable and had the plotting of a thriller that wasn't particularly realistic, let alone real.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
So we thought, you know, we would look back at how it felt to live through that. And, you know, our sort of guiding question was, you know, how similar was it to now? And what we found, you know, was that there were a lot of sort of micro parallels in addition to the macro parallel that we had sort of, you know, identified as a premise. And we didn't want to kind of beat people over the head with the Trump comparisons, because I think, first of all, it's always sort of a tricky business, you know, doing that kind of comparison when you're dealing with history. But also I think we kind of realized that the pleasure that we were taking in making the show came from the fact that we were kind of giving ourselves permission to not think about Trump quite as much. Like, yeah. I was covering the DOJ right before I started working on the show. And to me, it was felt like a real kind of vacation to just focus on something else. But I think what saved it from being like just escapist was that there are a lot of sort of insights that one can mine from the history that, that do help you process the present day.
Yeah, and this question you ask kind of throughout the podcast, like, would we know it today if we were living in something like a Watergate? Like, would you recognize it at the time? Or is it just you're just reacting to what's happening and you don't have a larger perspective almost?
That's right. And I think to wonder whether we would know it if we were living through another Watergate now is to wonder how this will all look in the future. You know, yeah. 45 years from now, will people look back on this period the way we look back on Watergate today?
What do people know about Watergate, like generally? I mean, I think people have an impression of what that was, and there are plenty of us who know all of the details. But just in a general sense, this seems like one of the things that the podcast really gets at is how much of the little stuff has, I think you said, kind of gone from our collective memory.
Yeah, I mean, that was something we had to reflect on every step of the way, was what should we treat as conventional wisdom, and what should we present to our audience as something that they're most likely going to think is new or unfamiliar. I didn't break any news in this show. You know, I didn't uncover anything that wasn't known to historians already. But, you know, my sort of decision early on was to treat my own level of knowledge about Watergate as a kind of anchor, and to sort of use that as a barometer for what we should present as novel. Right. So just to give an example, like when I read about the story of Martha Mitchell, who was the wife of Attorney General John Mitchell, that struck me as a completely insane tale that I couldn't believe wasn't, you know, the most famous thing about Watergate almost. Yeah. I read about Martha Mitchell in a number of books. It's not like her story hadn't been captured before.
Sure.
But it was, as you say, it had sort of fallen off the tree or whatever the right metaphor is.
Yeah.
You know, to answer your original question, what do people know about Watergate? I think the answer is actually quite simple. They know what's in All the President's Men, the movie.
Yep. Yeah.
It's just so dominant, the Watergate narrative, that I think we kind of lucked out in being able to use that as a touchstone, because we could just assume that most people we were talking to, most people who are listening to the show, have probably seen that film.
Yeah.
And they've probably not seen or read a whole lot else.
Yeah. And that film, and even the book in some ways, the film in particular, is a fraction of this incredibly long arc in the story.
Totally. And, I rewatched the movie, obviously, before I got too far into this process of researching the show. And I was sort of astonished to realize that it ended, you know, I think 6 months into the story.
Yeah.
You know, the length of time between the break-in and Nixon's resignation was about two – it was 2 years and 2 months. And I believe when the film ends, you see Woodward and Bernstein on their typewriters, and you see Nixon being inaugurated for a second term, which would have been January of 73. And so, you know, there was a whole lot else that happened after that that doesn't get covered except for, you know, in the sort of stylized montage that you see as, you know, the typewriter flashes headlines for you as the movie fades to black.
Let's talk a little bit about this Martha Mitchell story for those who need to be reacquainted with it. First of all,
yeah,
she was great, it seems like. You know, I mean, like, she partied, she talked too much, she was funny, hated liberals, but was still really charming. And say a little bit about her, because she was I have to say, I'm thankfully too young to remember most of that, but she was amazing.
Yeah, she really was sort of like in the dictionary under colorful character. As you say, she was outspoken. She very glamorous. You know, she liked to entertain, and she liked to gossip, and she liked to talk to reporters. You know, I think there was probably a somewhat darker side to her, in that she was probably, you know, someone who struggled with alcohol. But I think at time, you know, before Watergate, she sort of emerged as a new kind of Washington character. Like, there weren't really Washington wives in that mold before, who were celebrities sort of in their own right. And she really was a celebrity. Like, she really was widely known. I should look up this poll that I've referenced a few times to get the actual number. But the percentage of people who had heard of Martha Mitchell in 1971, according to, I think, a Gallup poll, was something on the order of 75%, which
wow.
is really insane penetration. You know, given how fractured our culture is now, to imagine anyone being that famous other than Donald Trump is quite a feat.
Yeah.
And so, yeah, part of what attracted me to her story was that putting aside everything that happened to her after Watergate, you know, just the mere fact that a person could be that famous and then completely unknown 45 years later to people who weren't around to watch her in real time was really striking to me.
Yeah. We don't need to spend a lot of time with her story. I will just say that she's in California with her husband, who was the attorney general at the time? He was a Nixon aide at the time.
He was Nixon's attorney general at the beginning of Nixon's first term, and then he switched to being the head of the reelection campaign.
Right.
He was running the reelection campaign.
Yeah. And they're in California. They're when, of course, news breaks, this break-in in the Democratic headquarters in the Watergate. And so he goes back to Washington, leaves her there because she wants to stay. There are parties and things, and puts this former FBI agent in charge of her because she tends to run off her mouth. John Mitchell doesn't want her to know the news. And you go through this in episode one, but somehow she gets a hold of it and it becomes this whole thing. But I think what's so interesting about it is, in some ways, like, there's this moment, like, and this is what you try to do with the podcast, give people a sense of what it was like before you knew something was going to break, before this was going to be a big thing. And this is one of those stories that, as you say in the podcast, everything is up in the air at this moment. And, and this is a good way to illustrate it, this crazy story, this crazy moment.
Yeah. I mean, the thing that I think they were specifically worried about was that she would, A, recognize the face of one of the five burglars because he had worked for her previously. Right. His name was James McCord, and he was someone who had been, I think, assigned as her driver. And so they were worried that if she read the paper, she would see his mugshot and realize that something was up.
Yep.
And then the second thing they were worried about was that she would tell someone, you know, that maybe she knew more about Watergate than they were even aware of. You know, as you said, she had this reputation for being a gossip, for being someone who liked to eavesdrop. She and her husband actually lived at the Watergate, which I didn't include in the show because I thought it would be too confusing to explain. I think it's sort of a red herring. But, you know, she was known to creep down the stairs during big meetings that her husband would hold in their apartment with other Nixon aides and other reelection officials and try to hear what they were talking about. You know, I think she would listen to his phone calls sometimes. So I think they really didn't know what she knew. And so they were scared, you know, given her reputation for talking to reporters and given her relationships in the media, that she would say something that she wasn't supposed to say.
Yeah. The way that story plays out is remarkable. And hearing her tape and her story, I have to say, the part she plays, the fact that she wants to, I mean, that she's so dismissed and then discredited and then just sort of thought of as this crazy alcoholic with mental issues, and seems to be also characteristic of the way, I have to say, the Nixon aides dealt with this. I mean, they could be pretty ruthless, and that seems like a theme in this story, discrediting those who wanted to speak out.
Certainly. I mean, the first thing they did was pull the phone out of the wall when they realized she was in fact talking to a reporter.
Helen Thomas.
Trying to talk to her. Yeah, Helen Thomas. The reporter from UPI. And Martha Mitchell had called her up and was starting to talk about Watergate. The FBI agent you mentioned, who was sort of her steward, pulled the phone out of the wall.
Yeah.
And later on, sort of when she became rather agitated, you know, and was demanding that she be allowed to leave this hotel in California, she was sedated. A doctor was called in and she was injected with a sedative so that she would stop fighting it, basically. And yeah, like you say, after that initial couple days passed, and Martha started telling people, anyone who would listen, that this was a Nixon operation. Yeah, they pretty systematically tried to convince the world that this was someone not worth listening to, that she was an alcoholic, that she was, you know, deluded. And actually, as I was sort of astonished to learn, when Nixon was interviewed by David Frost a couple of years later, sort of like a postmortem on the whole Watergate affair after his resignation, he, in a sense, blamed the whole thing on her.
Yeah.
You know, not because she called Helen Thomas, but because, in his view, she was such a distraction to her husband that he wasn't minding the store and that he wouldn't have let this happen, this Watergate thing, if only Martha had been better behaved and less of a handful.
There's a part of the podcast where you talk about, I love this part actually, where you talk about, as you put it, how much of a blast this was for people observing this thing unfolding. And I wanted to play a moment here. You're featured here, and also Dick Cavett, because you talked to Dick Cavett, who told you on the podcast, let me play this moment, that as you put it in the podcast, he looks back on those days wistfully.
I must say I miss it terribly. I think of it the way you would think of in your earlier years, you got to spend a year in Paris and you never got to go back. You can never go back. You can never get back to that wonderful feeling.
He brought up a comment that Gore Vidal made on his show.
I have to have my Watergate fix every single morning in the paper. I get like this if I haven't got...
There are Watergate junkies all over the place. No. People who just... It's because it's an important part of people's lives.
One of the things you say in the podcast is that if you're honest, you feel the same kind of feeling about what's happening right now with this investigation into, you know, the Trump campaign's ties to Russia. Would you say a little bit about that? That, and I think a lot of us feel that way. Like, what is going to happen next in this thing?
Yeah, I think it's probably easier for some people to feel some distance from it than it is for others. But certainly, as a reporter, you know, it's exciting. It's exciting that you're witnessing events that have never happened before. You're watching a story unfold in which you don't know the ending. The characters are incredible. I mean, you couldn't ask for a sort of more rollicking tale. I mean, obviously there's a queasiness attached to the excitement and anxiety, I think, about where all this is headed. I think that it's easy enough to sort of treat it as a soap opera, given sort of how the last year and change have gone. It's also easy enough to hold both things in your head at once. I mean, the sort of gravity of what's happening is obvious, just as kind of fun of it is obvious as well.
Yeah. That's Leon Neyfakh. He's a staff writer for Slate.com and the host of the podcast Slow Burn. You can find a link to it on our website, radiowest.org. We'll take a break and be back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West from KUER.
KUER's new project, The Hive Mind, puts you right in the newsroom with our reporters. Here's how it works. Look under the News and Programs tab at KUER.org, click on The Hive Mind, and you'll see what one of our reporters is working on. Maybe it's affordable housing or national parks fees. It changes. You tell us what you want to know, vote on other listeners' questions, and we'll try to figure it out. It's like this. The news is for you, and you should have some say in how we make it. Join the Hive Mind at KUER.org.
This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Today in the program, we're talking about what it was like to live through Watergate. We're profiling a podcast called Slow Burn. It's about the scandal that brought down Richard Nixon. And our guest is the host of the podcast, Leon Neyfakh. He's a staff writer for Slate.com. You can find a link to his podcast, Slow Burn, on our website, radiowest.org. I want to talk about in the early days of this. Let's like go to 1972, in the days after, or the time really as it starts to play out. And the news starts to come out about the shady dealings of the Nixon campaign operatives and these financial links between the burglars and the committee to reelect the president. And this just seems like huge news. But you say, and this is so interesting, for some reason, Watergate was not, as you put it, penetrating. Talk a little bit about that. Why do you figure? It seems like today that would be different, that if something like this breaks, it would be huge news. But it didn't seem to be catching on for some reason.
That's right. And I think there are a few reasons for why it didn't really catch on. I was sort of taken aback by how little it caught on.
Yeah.
You know, there were plenty of people in America who hadn't even really heard the word Watergate at the time of the 1972 election in November of 72, which was a couple months after the break-in. This was despite the efforts of reporters, Woodward and Bernstein most famously, but others as well. You know, there were a bunch of people working on the story, including at the LA Times, including at Newsweek, and at CBS, where Walter Cronkite put on, you know, an unprecedented kind of show of trying to focus the nation's attention on this story. He dedicated a huge amount of his show just before the election to telling the story of Watergate as it was understood at that time and kind of trying to draw the connections between the different players and trying to show people that this money that had been discovered in the bank accounts of some of the burglars originated with Nixon donors and had moved through the Nixon reelection campaign. People tried. People tried to sort of get the attention of the voters, but there was just not a lot of interest in it. And I think one of the reasons why is that the Nixon campaign and the Nixon administration were successful at kind of waving it away. They said, famously, this is nothing but a third-rate burglary. It's not worth commenting on. They also said that this was politics as usual, that this kind of thing happens all the time and it's not a big deal. I think that was probably the most effective. That's just me kind of guessing. I don't have any social science to back that up. But my sense is that painting it as just something that happens in politics and that the other side does it too and it always has was probably very effective in convincing people not to worry about this.
Yeah. Let me play a moment from the podcast. This is from episode 5. This is Jesse Helms. Many people remember this is the North Carolina senator. And this was in September of 1973. So if you think about that, we're right in the thick of this in some ways. And Jesse, I love this tape. I'm not sure where you got it, but he's on this conservative talk show program. And we'll also hear, by the way, in this section, Ronald Reagan. And if this gets to this idea that you were just talking about, how good the Republicans were at just saying, oh, this is politics as usual. It wasn't so bad. This gives you a sense of that. Here's another moment from Slow Burn.
No American citizen in his right mind believes in burglary or improper bugging, but this had been going on through many administrations.
That's North Carolina Senator Jesse Helms, who was speaking on a radio show hosted by a popular right-wing pundit named Clarence Mannion. This clip is from September of 1973.
I noticed in the press the other day, the FBI said that Franklin Roosevelt did it a lot. Truman did it, and Eisenhower did it, and Kennedy and Johnson. But it was all right. They didn't consider it a very horrendous thing, but this was something they could appall the American people with, so they made a great circus out of it.
Other politicians, like Ronald Reagan, went further. They insisted that nothing all that bad had even taken place.
There are some who would destroy a man in order to destroy a mandate of all the people. For America's sake, let's get on with the business of government.
That sounds familiar.
Yes.
Right? Indeed. I mean, it's got to be one of those. You've got to at least say something about the parallel there. And maybe this is just the way politics works. But you hear a lot of similar kinds of themes. I mean, there's a moment when George Bush Sr., for example, is saying, why can't these people just forget this and let Nixon get on with the business of government?
Yeah. And I think you put your finger on something a second ago when you said that maybe this is just how it always works in politics. One of the questions we had as we kind of identified these parallels was does this mean that Nixon and Trump share something in common, like in terms of their character, in terms of their political ideology or their political approach? Or is this just like, proof that there are some universal laws of gravity that, result in certain techniques and methods of being employed in crisis situations?
And the idea of attacking the media. Ron Ziegler, of course, famously went after. In fact, let me play a moment here. This is from I'm sure people will recognize or remember this. This was Nixon's press secretary, Ron Ziegler, going after, as he saw it, the liberal press. And, of course, he has in his mind the Washington Post.
And I use the term shoddy journalism, shabby journalism, and I've used the term character assassination. And that is exactly what I believe and what I feel is taking place here. This is a political effort by the Washington Post, well conceived and coordinated, to discredit this administration and individuals in it.
How good was the Nixon administration at deflecting? Seems like it worked for a long time. I mean, obviously people turned on Nixon eventually, and the tapes had a lot to do with that. But how good were they at basically covering it up and deflecting?
Yeah, I mean, good enough that he won in a massive landslide in 1972, in his reelection fight. That said, I do wonder whether the stuff that was happening behind the scenes, even during those first few months before public opinion sort of caught up to the scandal, I do wonder if the choices they made, the maneuvers they tried to execute early on, really had any chance for being sort of effective in the long term. As you said, like, eventually the chicken did come home to roost. I think March of 73 was a key inflection point when one of the burglars, same one who had previously been driving Martha Mitchell around, wrote a letter to the judge overseeing the original Watergate case to say that, you know, there were things that were left out of the testimony. There was perjury committed during this trial. And this scandal involves people in, they're higher up than the individuals who were indicted and convicted in connection to it. And so I think hearing from him really helped galvanize people. And I just don't know if there was much of anything that the Nixon administration could have done to prevent that. And it certainly, if whatever they tried in the end didn't work.
Yeah. Well, that is, I have to say, that's one of the things that's great about the podcast is it traces the arcs in the story of those moments when everything changes, and it seems like that James McCord letter was one of those. It just it absolutely transformed the story in some way.
Yeah, and that was sort of our goal at the beginning of the research process, was to try to identify the turning points, because it did go from a story no one cared about to a story that everyone cared about.
Yeah.
And we wanted to know how that happened and how it was that, you know, minds changed or attention became focused on it. And so, yeah, the McCord letter was one. And, of course, there were a few others down the line.
Yeah, the tapes. We'll get to that. But yes. I wanted to ask you about – I thought that was fascinated by this idea in the press that you talk about – you talk with the presidential historian Rick Perlstein in the podcast. Mm-hmm. And who talks about this idea that the press, for some reason – and I don't think it was just with Nixon, but they were looking for the president to – sort of come into his own, to assume the grandeur of the role of presidency, and in Nixon in particular, to stop being this kind of grubby guy and and become the guy who went to China. So here's Rick Perlstein, and we'll hear you on this as well, and David Brinkley, by the way, another moment where Perlstein is talking to you about how the press was always looking for signs that Nixon had turned over a new leaf. Here's another moment from Slow Burn.
And the way the media shorthand shook out was that there was the old Nixon and the new Nixon. The new Nixon, you know, was kind of rediscovered every, you know, couple of years, kind of like the media is desperate to see, you know, the Donald Trump who's able to read a teleprompter as this distinguished fellow. So that's an old pattern.
Against that backdrop, the Watergate story looked like a curiosity that couldn't possibly have anything to do with the president. And that's how it was played in most of the media, as a caper, not a criminal conspiracy or a political scandal. Here's NBC's David Brinkley in an opinion piece that aired in September of 72.
The cast of the Watergate caper is full of silent, shadowy figures, like those faces in the pictures on post office walls, those with the caption saying, "Wanted three-finger Willie Brown, has a scar on his neck, walks with a limp, and smokes nickel cigars." But all the evidence we find is that as a political issue, it is falling flat, influencing very few votes, if any.
I have to say, it made me miss David Brinkley. so great. Back to this idea, do you think this concept that it couldn't have anything to do with the president, are we more jaded now, or do you still think that is the way we think? Do you know what I mean? Like, even for this,
about the current president?
Yeah,
yeah,
I think in general.
Well, I do think Nixon in particular, and Nixon in 1972 in particular, had a claim to sort of this elevated status as a statesman, someone who had, as you say, gone to China, and someone who had, you know, made progress on arms control with the Soviet Union. Mm-hmm. He was someone operating on the world stage, and people were sort of ready to see him as above it all, you know, and in fact, when he was running for re-election in 1972, part of their strategy was to sort of present him as the president, not as a candidate. I'm sure that's true about all incumbents running.
Yeah.
They want to, you know, minimize the extent to which they're seen as mere candidates. But he really, you know, leaned into that, and I think it helped people wave away the possibility that he was in any way involved in this, as you say, grubby operation. You know, today, I think even Trump's admirers, I think, would have to agree that, like, he's not someone who, you know, is operating on this sort of elevated plane. He's not someone who is trying to, or at least is succeeding at presenting himself as a dignified, you know, statesman. Even in his dealings with North Korea, you know, he's doing it in a plain-spoken manner. He's doing it in a way that makes the work of diplomacy seem more human-scaled than it does make Trump seem
presidential.
Kind of bigger, you know? You know what I mean? Like he, like even the work that he's doing at the on the global stage looks like the work of a of an individual rather than, you know, the sort of abstract giant, which I think is what Nixon was going for.
Right. And it, I have to say, it gets to one of the most important, at least for me, as I was going through this, one of the most important themes in the podcast. And that is, and this is a question you ask, this is in episode 5, why did so many Americans continue to stand by Richard Nixon, even as it became clear that he had, you know, abused his power? I mean, how did his admirers and his base, how did they stay with him as all this evidence is piling up? And I want to get to Gail Sheehy because I think her role in the podcast is really fascinating. Talk a little bit about her. Now, she's a journalist, was working for the New York Times during all of this, and they sent her
New York Magazine.
Forgive me, New York Magazine. And they send her to Astoria, Queens, to a bar, to get a sense of how Nixon's base, you know, the blue-collar workers there who liked Nixon, even though they were, a lot of them were Dems, they were Democrats. Talk a little bit about this part, because I thought this was really interesting, what this revealed about why people and how long they're willing to stick with their guy.
Yeah, so reading Gail Sheehy's piece, her dispatch from this bar in Queens, was sort of one of the first times where I couldn't quite believe the similarities between then and now, because you read these quotes from these guys who are talking about Nixon being, you know, a real man and being a powerful guy who's going to tame these like weakling liberals. There's, you know, in the bar that Gail reported from, there was a sign, like a novelty diploma or something like that behind the bar that said, it wasn't a diploma, it was an award. It was like a certificate. It's the Nobody of the Year Award. And,
right.
And Gail's point was like, these guys drew a lot of their identity from their alignment with Nixon. And of course, that resonates pretty forcefully when you think about sort of the disaffected Trump voter who sees Trump as, you know, their best sort of hope for regaining status in this country.
Can I play a moment from Gail Sheehy
from
the podcast here? Because I think this is where she – this is where I agree with you. This was the connection between – the kind of Trump base now and the Nixon base then really came clear for me. Here's Gail Sheehy from Slow Burn.
They, you know, saw this eruption in 68, the anti-war movement, the civil rights movement, promoting blacks, denigrating our war, and then the women's movement. I mean, it was overwhelming. They couldn't stand it. So they gravitated towards this man who appeared to speak for them, who was pro-war when he came in, who was a closet racist, who was very down on intellectuals and liberals.
I wonder if you think, I mean, if you think about the particulars of change are obviously different. Then it was civil rights and, you know, feminism. Now it's immigration and changing economy. But that kind of anxiety does help explain something, I think, doesn't it?
Sure. And I think, you know, one of the sort of more striking quotes from Gail's piece was someone saying, I'd welcome Nixon as an authoritarian. You know, I'd let him be dictator. I think that the country would be better off.
Yeah.
So there's sort of a grasping at control in that sentiment. There's a sort of grasping for order, you know, that you get when you have an authoritarian in charge. I think another thing that the Gail Sheehy stuff made me think was that much of the persistent loyalty people felt towards Nixon was just tribal. It was just like, we don't like the guys going up against him. We don't like these cosmopolitan, you know, pencil-necked, you know, politicians or journalists, you know, in New York and D.C. going after our guy. And that, you know, that's a very powerful thing.
I think one of the original insights that you offer in the podcast is how the story of this secret taping system in the White House that becomes revealed, and you work through that in the podcast, and you talk about how that story is a really good example of how tribalism that lived under the surface of the Senate Watergate Committee played out. Would you talk a little bit about this, just like the sense that there was this bipartisan cooperation, but there was the question was whether or not there was I'll use a word that has a lot of baggage today, but collusion between the White House and the Republicans who are investigating Watergate along with the Democrats. Would you just talk a little bit about this part? Because I thought this was an interesting insight.
Yeah. So I was actually really surprised by what I found when I looked into the role of partisanship in the Senate Watergate Committee. I had sort of assumed that it was true that when people talked about, the days of Watergate, when people put country over party and truth over their tribe, I just assumed that there wouldn't be this level of partisanship. And in fact, there was. Despite the fact that in public, the Republican members of the Senate Watergate Committee were, or at least some of them, were quite tough on Nixon's accusers, chief among them John Dean, the White House counsel, who decided to testify about Nixon's role in the conspiracy to cover up the burglary. The reality was that in behind the scenes, there was a Democratic staff and there was a Republican staff. And, everything I gathered from talking to folks who worked on the Democratic side was that they considered the Republicans their opponents. They didn't share information with them. They didn't. They worried that if they did, it would get leaked or that it would get passed on to the White House. And, in fact, there was quite a bit of evidence that Republican members of the committee were working with the White House to try to prepare for certain witnesses. I think, again, to reference John Dean, there was a set of questions that was passed to Howard Baker by the White House, with suggestions basically for how to nail this guy. Yeah. So I think there was less sort of bipartisan harmony than we would like to think now that it's been 45 years.
One of the questions that comes up in the podcast also is, as now the first steps toward impeachment are starting to become clear, that the House of Representatives establishes this committee to inquire about all of this, and you devote some time to this question, and you write about you talk about how the process was kind of fuzzy. Like, no one knew, like, what are we supposed to do? What does impeachment even mean? How does this work? And
that's right.
And this was interesting too. Like, what is a high crime and misdemeanor?
We still don't really know.
Yeah, we don't really know. And I have to say that let me play a moment. This is Elizabeth Holtzman. Maybe explain who she is, because she's a brand new congresswoman when this story starts to play out.
She was very young, like a lot of the people who turned out to be key players in this saga. She was like in her 30s when all this was happening. She'd just been elected to the House of Representatives. She was from Brooklyn, and she was put on the House Judiciary Committee over her protest. She wanted to be on a different committee, and she didn't think the House Judiciary Committee would be an interesting place to work. She turned out to be quite wrong. She was very quickly swept up in history. She explained to me that, she and her colleagues didn't know what impeachment really was. There had been one instance of it in history, in American history, and it was not particularly it involved Andrew Johnson. And as she explained to me, that was seen as a failure. I mean, it was an extremely partisan operation, and she and her colleagues wanted to do it differently this time.
The high crime and misdemeanor was really a political crime. It's not a normal crime. It's not like shooting your wife or your husband or running somebody over because you're drunk, but it's an abuse of power.
That's so interesting. And I think it underscores, as you hear kind of cavalier talk about impeachment related, not so cavalier from a lot of people's perspective, but the idea of impeachment related to what may have happened in the Trump administration now. And it makes you realize that an impeachment process is a political thing. There's a political dimension
totally
to it. Yeah.
Yeah. It has sort of the veneer of a legal process, but in fact, it's a totally, totally political process. I think I'm stealing that phrase, the veneer of a legal process, from Peter Baker, who I heard recently talking about the Clinton impeachment, which is the subject of Slow Burn Season 2. But, it has the word crime in it, right? High crimes and misdemeanors. Misdemeanor sounds like a legal term. But in fact, these were terms that needed to be defined. And as Holtzman pointed out to me, there was no way that high crimes and misdemeanors, when written in the Constitution, could have been a reference to the criminal code, because there was no federal criminal code when those words were written. And so it's entirely up to Congress to decide what it means and what rises to that level. And so, yeah, their first step was to, like, read the one book that had been written up to that point, coincidentally been published just a few years earlier, about the legal underpinnings of impeachment.
And no one was reading it then until this thing happened.
Yeah, it was, I mean, it was like an obscure legal tome by a guy named Raoul Berger. And, and suddenly it was, I don't think it was a bestseller. I wish I could have, I wish I could say it became a bestseller, but the best I could find was that, you know, according to some, according to a couple articles I found, it became a common sight to see it on the coffee tables of politically engaged people in Georgetown and D.C.
Yeah. I want to talk about another moment in the podcast where you explore this, the kind of the ambivalence by some Republican members of Congress as they start to see the chips falling where they are. And the questions for them, at what point do they ditch, you know, the president, the person that they'd been vocal in support, and at what point do they give in, and how much courage did they express? I mean, what did you see in that part of this story?
I mean, they really waited until the last second, to be honest. I mean, it wasn't really until Nixon had lost, you know, public support after the Saturday Night Massacre and after his continued refusal to hand over various audio tapes from the White House recording system to the special prosecutor and to Congress, and it became a matter for the Supreme Court. The Supreme Court ruled that Nixon did have to turn over these tapes that he was up to that point refusing to turn over, and it was when it turned out that one of those tapes contained what's now known as the smoking gun, in which Nixon was saying essentially that we should use the CIA to put a stopper on this FBI investigation into the Watergate break-in. The people realized there was really no wiggle room left. Forget saying that this was no big deal or this was merely a third-rate burglary, but there was no room even to say that Nixon himself was just the president, just someone who had employed people who did these bad things. You know, that tape really proved that he was engaged in the process of covering this up and was willing to use, you know, the organs of government to do so. And after that, it was just, you know, that was a wrap.
Yeah.
And I think he was facing enormous pressure to resign because it was understood that if the Senate were to take a vote, he would be removed from office.
Would you say something about Barbara Jordan? You play in the podcast, and we'll play a little moment here, but a speech that she makes on the floor of the – well, I guess in anticipation of this House hearing, and it's really eloquent, and you highlight it as a, I think, as kind of an important moment here. Would you talk a little bit about this moment?
I became kind of extra sensitive to the moments in this story that people do remember as I went through the history. Like, there was so much that people don't remember that anything that did penetrate to the point of still being sort of in the collective imagination meant something to me. And I think Barbara Jordan's speech is deservedly well-known, deservedly remembered, because it was an eloquent kind of articulation of what was so offensive about what Nixon had done and what was so kind of heartbreaking about the whole process. And it got to, I think, what was important to realize about this entire impeachment process, especially for people who have only lived through the Clinton impeachment, that for all the, you know, point scoring that I'm sure everyone on both sides was engaged in, there was a feeling on both sides, and I would say including on the part of the Democrats who really wanted Nixon out for, you know, ideological reasons, they sensed how grave a move this was to remove a president. They understood the stakes and the severity of this decision to overturn the will of the American people. Again, he was reelected by a landslide. This was. And this was not that long after. I mean, to remove a president after that kind of vote is it's not something you do lightly. And I think Barbara Jordan's speech really underscored that. And I think the emotion in her voice really communicated it.
I felt somehow for many years that George Washington and Alexander Hamilton just left me out by mistake. But through the process of amendment, interpretation, and court decision, I have finally been included in We the People.
Jordan's point was that despite this history, she still believed in the Constitution and felt sorrow at seeing it subverted by Richard Nixon.
Today, I am an inquisitor. And hyperbole would not be fictional and would not overstate the solemnness that I feel right now. My faith in the Constitution is whole, it is complete, it is total. And I am not going to sit here and be an idle spectator to the diminution, the subversion, the destruction of the Constitution.
So Richard Nixon, of course, resigns in August 1974. And as you put it in the podcast, just like that, he was gone. And you say, so that's a happy ending, right? But then you raise these questions, you know, and I want to ask you about this finally. Did the system work? Because that's the question. Like, oh, it seems like it worked. That politicians, as you say in the podcast, they chose truth over party affiliation. And the president's misdeeds were exposed and he was forced out of office. And that meant the system worked. But that's not really your conclusion. It's in some ways what you're saying is we're just damn lucky that it worked.
Yeah, I think my conclusion was that there is no system, or that there is a system, but it requires the buy-in and the sort of active participation of individuals who are willing to take risks and are willing to arrive at difficult conclusions. And that it requires just pushing from so many different institutions. You have pressure exerted on the White House, and that pressure doesn't exist on its own. And the constitutional system that we have makes it possible for that pressure to act on three branches of government, but it's not enough. Yeah. You know, the fact that the structure is in place doesn't mean that the pressure will actually materialize. And the pressure materialized because individuals did their jobs. And so my conclusion is not that this was always going to end this way. It was there was nothing inevitable about this. And I think insofar as the series is comforting to people who think that Donald Trump should be removed from office, because, you know, it seems to prove that, you know, misconduct at this level doesn't go unpunished. I think it's comforting only because it means that there's a chance, there's a possibility, that there's a chance that this pressure will materialize. And that's something. I think that's a reason for those people to be for those people who want to see Trump removed from office. It's a reason to be optimistic for them. But I think it I do hope that the kind of contingent nature of these events and the fact that so much stuff happened to break the way it did, as opposed to being kind of mandated by any kind of universal laws of political gravity, is a reminder that we can't just sort of sit back and wait for the gears to turn on their own.
Well, let's tease season two really quickly. I know you're just in the process of all of this and you don't want to give anything away, but this is about the Clinton impeachment. What's the theme as it's developing now as you're seeing it?
Yeah, so we are still in the middle of it. We're going to launch the new season in August. And initially, I really thought that our focus would be on Bill Clinton, Monica Lewinsky, and the scandal that erupted in 1998 and led directly to his impeachment. But the more I sort of studied the story, I realized this almost as soon as I started studying the story, you can't explain how it got to that point without rewinding back to 1992 and explaining, you know, the Paula Jones lawsuit and the Whitewater land deal that led to the appointment of the special prosecutor. You know, these things had to kind of merge with the Lewinsky story before the impeachment could take place. And so, you know, as far as themes, I think we are less focused this time around on what it felt like to live through it, because honestly, so much of the story happened behind closed doors I think if you wanted to focus on the kind of the public reaction to it, you really would focus on 1998. And that's where, you know, you could sort of focus on how liberals reacted and how conservatives responded. And we're definitely going to do that. But I think we're doing more about the events themselves and less on the sort of public reception of the events.
Leon Neyfakh, he's the host of the podcast Slow Burn from Slate. You can find a link to it on our website, radiowest.org. Leanne joined us from Slate's studios in Brooklyn. Radio West is a production of KUWER News. We had technical direction from Tim Slover, the program produced by Benjamin Bombard and Elaine Clark. I'm Doug Fabrizio.